good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of October 11th, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, your host for the show and an executive editor here at Information Week. We have a great panel today, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun on the show, which is a good thing because, well, there's some news of the week that's fun, and as usual, some that's less fun, but we'll try to help you survive all of it regardless. Joining me on the panel today, we have Sarah Peters, a senior editor from our sister site, Dark Reading, here to scare the willies out of all of us on computer security. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kirk.
We have Information Week contributor and all-around digital raconteur, Larry Loeb. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I recant.
You recant, and do it well, I might say. And also, as we have my usual partner in crime, Dave Wagner, Information Week's executive editor for Community and author of the popular Geekend column here at Information Week. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kurt. Thanks for having me.
Well, now, I was talking at the very beginning about the fact that some of the news was good, some of the news was bad, but it seems like this is a week where we've pretty much avoided utter disaster. Or has there been a disaster that I missed somewhere? Anybody got a disaster on their radar?
A lot of people think Dell fell into a disaster.
Okay, now that is the big story, and of course that broke early in the week. So Dave, tell me what your take is about the whole Dell takeover of EMC.
I have to say it was a good joke to say that it was a disaster, but I think it's actually going to be perfectly fine. I don't think it's going to be special. I think basically both companies are going to chug along as one larger company doing pretty much exactly what they were doing before. I hate to say this about a $68 billion deal, but it's kind of the dullest $68 billion deal I could ever imagine reading about, in the sense that in a lot of ways, EMC and Dell are the same company now. A lot of people think of Dell as a PC maker, and they are, obviously, but they have for quite a long time been trying to become more of a managed services technology provider, much the way EMC is. They are in much of the same spaces, security, storage, cloud. I think this is going to strengthen both companies in terms of getting customers. But customers are a little weary right now, and I don't blame them, because a lot of people who have been loyal EMC customers don't know very much about Dell outside of laptops, and a lot of people in Dell are wondering whether Dell is going to get kind of swallowed up a little bit in the deal. But I think this is just one of those perfectly fine, two smaller companies became one bigger company kind of technology deal.
Well, I have to say one of the things that surprised me about the whole thing was the way that EMC was described in so many of the news items. And that was, they were talking about Dell buying cloud computing company EMC. And I'll admit, I tend to think of EMC first and foremost as an enterprise storage vendor. Larry, I want to turn to you. When you think of EMC, assuming you think of them at all, do you tend to think of them as a cloud company or a storage company or something else entirely?
I'm in the something else entirely camp. They own RSA Security, for instance, which has been one of the major players in a long time in security and has just barely recovered from having to admit the NSA paid them $10 million to fudge some things so that the NSA could crack them. They also own VMware, which is going to be spun off, I guess. But still, that's a big player in virtualization in the cloud.
Well, you mentioned that the very first thing, RSA, and Sarah, I want to ask you this question. You know, RSA is, frankly, about as big a company as exists in the security space, and in addition to their products, they have the RSA conference, which is a big deal. What's your take on this? Do you see Dell as being a good steward for all that RSA represents?
No, I don't. But at the same time, I don't want to count them out entirely, because I was nervous when Dell took over SecureWorks, actually, and but I think that Dell SecureWorks has actually been continued to be a really innovative company. You know, we talked to them a lot about their research, and they've continued to be a really great company. So I'm thinking that if RSA kind of has the same experience that SecureWorks has had being under the Dell purview, then maybe it'll all be fine. I think it's just if as long as Dell kind of keeps its hands off of everything, it's just so, you know, something that one of our colleagues here, Charlie Babcock, said on an internal call. I don't think he would mind if I mentioned it. He said something, I wish I could remember exactly his words, but it was something to the effect of whether anything that's been bought by Dell has really excelled after being bought by it. And I don't know that has really happened, that everything's just kind of been fine, but has anything really been improved by the purchase? And this is not really my my forte. I'm not really a tech business person. So I can just say that I see SecureWorks has done well. I don't know that they have been improved, but I think that they have managed to continue to do really, really great work. And I'm hoping that RSA will continue to do really, really great work. But I don't know that they will be able to do any more than they were able to do before. I don't see that Dell is going to give them anything better than what they've had in the past. And I hope that they won't be injured by the relationship.
It's an interesting thing about tech acquisitions, period. I have difficulty thinking about any large ticket technology acquisition that has led to giant success in that way. I mean, there are patent acquisitions that have allowed companies to grow, without a doubt, right? But I can't think of a situation where a company has bought a smaller company, allowed it to keep its name and operate with some independence, that then that company has, you know, flourished into some giant company on its own. I'm sure there's one that I'm forgetting. I'm sure each of you will embarrass me by coming up with one. But I think that it's interesting, because tech acquisitions for the purpose of growing revenue and companies don't seem to do as well as tech acquisitions based around acquiring a technology.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you put it that way, because as I look at the companies that Dell has acquired, most of them have been relatively mature companies. You know, going all the way back to companies like Perot Systems, they tend to buy them to stake out or buy entry into a market segment where they don't have any real strength. And so apparently their strategy is to buy a company that already has some sort of mature presence there. And thinking about what Sarah said, to me the highest compliment that I can think of for Dell's management of these acquisitions is that they tend to not have screwed them up.
Yeah.
you know, they've taken the ones that I'm fairly familiar with, and I'm thinking of companies like SonicWall that I have known and followed for years. Dell has kept a fairly hands-off approach to what goes on there. And so if that continues with EMC, it seems to me that at the very least it would be reassuring to the EMC employees who have to be wondering whether they're going to have to go to the barbecue place that will be built on the outskirts of Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Well, that certainly sort of swamped the early part of the week in terms of news. Has there been anything else? Has everybody been sort of taking stock of what that's going to mean? Or are other companies moving ahead and doing interesting things? I've got something that I'll mention in a couple of minutes that was introduced today, but I'm curious of, you know, what you folks have had your eyes on.
Well, just yesterday, the Department of Justice issued some charges that are being considered the very first cyber terror charges against an individual. A man who is currently now in Malaysia. He's awaiting some extradition hearings. He was charged with hacking and with taking the records that he stole and handing them over to ISIS. So that is the new news. And if he is convicted, he will face up to 35 years in prison.
Well, that's
Obama.
Is. Go ahead, Larry.
Obama also has decided not to force back doors into encryption streams, which was not all that surprising, since it may not have actually done much except for your local sheriff's department. But it's still some encouraging trend.
That is encouraging. And it's interesting when you to think about the regulation angle. I was fascinated today. I saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal. Apparently, there is a large set of negotiations going on around what are essentially potentially weaponized malware and system monitoring and spyware software and what could be exported, what could be imported, and the licenses required, with a basic eye towards requiring the vendors of certain levels of software to obtain the same sort of licenses that the manufacturers of tanks and rocket-propelled grenades and cruise missiles and other big military weapons have to obtain. But the problem is that when they defined this software, they did it so broadly that by some counts, any system monitoring or any security software would be subject to these very stringent armament licensing rules. And not surprisingly,
yes,
these software vendors have started screaming loudly about this. And according to the Wall Street Journal, the administration has listened and has gone back to all of our trading partners going, let's see about rewriting these, which could delay the entire process by at least a year. It seems
you were talking
like,
about the Wassenaar arrangement, are you not?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Yeah, there were a number of security companies. It's particularly a problem for U.S. security companies, and really only U.S. security companies, because it's kind of a voluntary thing. It prevents them from. I think the way that it's worded is that it's either exploit software or do you remember the actual words that are used? It's essentially exactly as you described it, but it's got rules about the export, not just of the software itself, but also about information related to exploits and to exploit software and for penetration testing software and all of these other things that security researchers routinely use, not just the bad guys, but the good guys. So it really inhibits all of their work, and it would render a lot of things that they do essentially illegal unless they get special permissions, and it would make it impossible for them to have conversations with people overseas without going through this big, giant rigmarole. And they're worried that it would also inhibit their ability to get to compete for talent as well, because they would not be able to get the same kinds of professionals who are stationed in other kinds of countries. It would slow down the ability to respond to threat intelligence that they could get from other sources, because they'd have to go through this process of obtaining permissions to get it because of all of these different trade agreements and all of these legal things that they would have to jump through. So yeah, White Hat Security and a number of other companies got together to stop the things. I think it was Intrusion Software. I think that's the jargon that they're using. Put a hold on it earlier in the summer, and now they're redoing the entire thing. It's the Wassenaar Arrangements, and it's a big, big quagmire. But the fact that it did not go through the way they first planned it is actually very, very good news. And the fact that it's being delayed is something we should be very pleased with, as opposed to being sad about.
Okay, but let me ask what I think is an important question here. So through the time that they're rewriting it, does mm-hmm. that mean there's basically no arrangement or agreement at all, and so people can go do whatever it is that they want to do? You know, because if we thought there was a reason to limit these things or monitor them or license them or whatever words we want to use, not doing anything for another year doesn't necessarily make me feel very good.
All it was is basically the Wassenaar Arrangement is an international arms agreement between 41 different countries, okay? And the only thing, it didn't cover cyber weapons. And these updates that were proposed were this effort to cover cyber weapons. And the rules were just going to apply to U.S. companies. And the funny thing is that, so you're right, that everybody will still be able to do whatever, but it's not like there hadn't been a rule in place to begin with, so we're not kind of taking a step backward, but this rule that they haven't put in place would have only been on American companies. It wouldn't have been elsewhere. And the timing of the whole thing is kind of ironic anyway, because I don't know if you'll recall, but Hacking Team, that Italian firm that sold surveillance and exploit tools to foreign government agencies, including the United States government, there is this what they call a gray market out there of selling zero-day vulnerabilities and all of these exploit tools out there, so that you can, if you are an Italian company or if you are a Syrian company or if you are a French company, you can sell intrusion software to another government, and it's legal. And while this is going on, now the Wassenaar arrangement is trying to prevent that from happening, but our own government was buying something from an Italian company while at the same time trying to prohibit our companies from doing the same thing to, you know, selling that kind of software to the Italians.
Well, at least they should buy American. That's silly.
Exactly. So it's like there's two different. It's a very very weird. It's a very very weird thing going on. This whole gray market in exploits that's going on. So I think I don't know. I'm not for the rules as they were proposed, but I think it would be, I think at some point it does need to be updated to include cyber weapons, but at the same time, it's really sticky to try to define what that is, because trying to define what is used intentionally as a, you know, for malicious purposes and what is used just for testing is very tricky to do when you're, you know, when you're doing information security. It's just a very, very blurry line.
Well, and as we're starting to see, there are a lot of companies that would very much like to make that line less blurry by simply making all research done by anyone not in their employ illegal. We're starting to see a lot more activity around DMCA takedown orders and stop orders around that very concept, and not just in the world of enterprise IT. It's going out for things like tractor repair and people working on things, much like the story that's been all over the news in recent weeks about Volkswagen and their cheat, which was uncovered by someone doing what was essentially some security-type research on their software and discovering these mysterious subroutines in there. Under some of the new proposals, that would be illegal on the face of it. So this is going to be one of those areas that we're going to be talking about, I think, for a long time to come from a bunch of different angles.
You know, we haven't even begun to discuss the TPP as it applies to software. WikiLeaks has leaked some provisions of it that will probably cause screaming and moaning from almost everybody. The extensions of copyright and all sorts of governmental interference on a number of areas.
Well, Larry, I've got to admit, I haven't really dug into TPP. Is this something that you've got an article already up on or that you're doing some research on?
No, I'm just being a raconteur because, TPP has not really been released yet in any meaningful way, and to base any real discussion on WikiLeaks is a slippery slope at best. However, I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of discussion going on if what they're putting out there actually is correct.
Well, this absolutely sounds like something that that more research needs to be done on. This is one of those wonderful areas where it seems like governments have voted to do something, and they'll let everyone know the details of what they've agreed to later. So I think this is another one of those things.
Yeah, I agree totally there. This seems like, hello, we did a deal. We're not going to tell you till it's too late.
Gotta love that.
And then they'll fine you for your lack of compliance.
Yes. That's how you'll find out what's in it when you're arrested for doing something against the whole thing. Well, on slightly happier news, I was really pleased. I'm working on a story right now that will probably go up sometime over the weekend. The last couple of years, Intel has chosen the Rome, that's Rome, Italy, Maker Fair as the place where they introduce new boards for developers and makers and educators. And they did it again this year. They have introduced a product that is called the Genuino 101, if you're not in the U.S. In the U.S., it's being called the Arduino 101. And essentially, it's one of these great little Arduino boards. But at its heart, it has the new Intel Curie system on a chip, which is in turn based on the Intel Quark microcontroller. More power, more capabilities, all in the same form factor as the Arduino, and this is important, using the same software development environment. And best of all, they're going to sell it for the same price, which is somewhere $25 or less. This is really cool, I think. Intel is looking around and finding out that all of a sudden they're not selling nearly as many processors for desktop computers as they used to, and they're looking at things like the Arduino as a way to keep those chip foundries humming along. So I'm encouraged by the fact that we're going to have a whole new set of capabilities for all those kids out there doing neat stuff with Arduino. And here's my question to the panel. Is turning young people loose on a platform like this a good thing, or are we just encouraging the creation of a new generation of hackers and electronic ne'er-do-wells? What do you think?
I think it's a good thing. First of all, I think that not all hackers are bad. they're not all going to be ne'er-do-wells. Second of all, knowledge is good, and I also want my nephew, who is currently a self-described nerd who loves Legos, he needs to be able to graduate to something else that he can get his hands on, and I think that this sounds like the next thing that he might want to do. He just wrote a poem about Legos, and I think that I could see, like, 5 years from now, maybe he'll be writing a poem about Arduinos.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Try to rhyme Arduino, though.
You know, well,
Free
he'll, maybe
day.
He'll
Free
have
birth.
To learn, like, Italian or something, and then he'll, I'm sure there'll be more to go along with it. There'll be an opera.
Yeah, but what about the Raspberry Pi?
That's Kurt's domain. He wrote... You've written several stories about Raspberry Pi, haven't you?
Yeah, well, I love the Raspberry Pi. And if you want to do something that requires the power of a Linux platform, it's great. But to me, the downside is that you've got to learn how to work inside a Linux development environment, which carries with it a little bit of complexity. The Arduino is just bone simple to work on. I can honestly see turning a six-year-old loose on an Arduino, and within a very few minutes, they'll be able to make blinky lights happen. And I think that's really cool.
To me, the key here, it'd be great to turn children on to these things, and I think that's fantastic. But to me, the real genius of these kinds of devices is that for a while in the 80s and 90s, early zeros, it was difficult to imagine doing technology in your garage anymore at an industrial scale. We lost the sort of Wright brothers or Jobs and Woz or Hewlett and Packard sort of we can do this on our own dime in our own garage sort of technology growth. And what I think is great about these things is it's going to allow people, again, much like drones are and 3D printing are, to sort of reimagine a world in their garage and build billion-dollar companies from it. And I think every technology that puts the ability to innovate in the hands of a young person is a good thing.
And it's got to be less exciting for parents than the chemistry sets that I had as a kid, which, with a little encouragement from my great uncle, could be used to create fairly entertaining explosive devices, and did. You know, we were talking. A company has sent me something that I'm going to be doing a review on in a week or so for our weekend. It's called the Cookie, and it's essentially a set of Arduino-based boards that are, call them an inch and a half on a side, but they're designed to work with Legos. So you can very easily pair these with Legos in order to make little things that light up and make noise and can tell you when something has run into something else. It's not cheap, but it's a cool little way of getting into Arduino and making exciting things happen for kids. So to me, it's fascinating when I go to maker fairs and when I talk to educators to see all the people who are excited about the different products that are coming online for these markets. And speaking of building things, Dave, it seems like, if I'm not mistaken, your geekend for this week was about our tolerance for wabi-sabi robots or something like that?
Yes. This is important to understand within the context of this information, which is that last week you and I were at Gartner, as everybody has probably heard ad infinitum at this point, and one of Gartner's predictions was that by 2018, 3 million people worldwide will have a robot for a boss. Now, keep that information in mind as I tell you this, which is that a research team from the University of Lincoln in England, not in Nebraska, did a study showing that humans prefer robots that have the same kind of cognitive biases that humans do. That we're far more comfortable with imperfect robots, robots that have problems remembering things, robots that have emotional empathy problems, so that a robot that could be incredibly happy or incredibly sad, regardless of how you feel about what's going on, and an inability to understand your emotions and instead just has its own. Robots with prejudices, essentially. And that humans much, much, much prefer robots that essentially have the same flaws we do. And right now, that's not that big of a deal because when we talk a robot, we're mostly talking really not very sophisticated things right now. But the frightening thing about it is, as Gartner points out, more and more robots are entering the enterprise. They say that by 2018, 5% of economic transactions are going to be run by robots and AI without any human control over it at all. There are other things that they say about robots. They say that in the next 5 years, we're going to go from cooperating with robots to competing with robots. If all of these things happen through AI and robots, it's an interesting problem, which is, do you want an imperfect a purposely flawed robot walking around the office just because it makes somebody more comfortable. And it's the kind of question that is surprisingly something we need to answer sooner than I think anybody realized that they were going to have to answer.
Well, I want to go on record as saying that my human boss has no perceptible flaws whatsoever. Therefore, you know, the robot with flaws would be useful for differentiating it from my human boss. Not that she will ever listen to the recording of this program and judge me on it. But I just wanted to get that out there.
That sounded like you were saying that there was an imperfection there, Kurt.
No, perceptible. Let's say if there are imperfections, someone at a much higher level than I exist will have to find them. That's all I'm saying.
I would like to make sure that this robot is not as pretty as me. I would like that to be designed in. I think that's just a given. I'd like to be able to choose what the imperfections are. I think there are certain imperfections that I can accept for us.
The robot's going to be Japanese anyway.
But I guess that's true. It's trying to decide what imperfections are acceptable and what aren't. And how long, and by whose standards.
Huh. You know, that last question is one that's interesting because one of the participants in our online conversation just made basically the same point, saying that perfection is in the eye of the beholder. What is an imperfection and what is a, you know, charming quirkiness? I don't know. And do we have vastly different standards for robots than we do for human beings? As Dave said, I think this brings us into a whole new world at a blistering pace, really.
Right. Well, right now they're specifically testing cognitive biases. There are about 20 commonly recognized cognitive biases that humans have. They tested two so far. They're testing others. Cognitive bias, a common one that would be kind of frightening to imagine that we want in a robot, is many humans do what we call heuristic thinking, shortcut thinking, thinking from the gut, right? They see a situation they think is like something else they've seen, and they make a quick, fast judgment, and this saves brain power, right? This is a requirement of our brain. If we don't do this occasionally, we really don't have the energy to make decisions, right? But the idea of that kind of cognitive bias in a robot, somebody who, you know, a robot that shoots from the hip, essentially, that makes decisions without enough data, that's a frightening concept when that robot is deciding how to deploy a human in a situation, or how to decide whether to purchase a stock or not purchase a stock. We have to remember, robot here we think of as sort of, you know, C-3PO or Data or something, but robot here also means a piece of software, an algorithm that is going to make a decision in a market. It's going to make it, you know, Amazon already has robot managers in its warehouses. Robots, AI, software, deploy people in the warehouse. People do not deploy people in Amazon's warehouse anymore. So when you're talking about these kinds of things, you're not talking about imperfections in the sense of, you know, are they funny or not, or are they attractive or not? You're talking about decision-making failures that humans traditionally make, that we are, in fact, trying to use big data to get out of making. You know, we're actually trying to create data-driven enterprises to make up for our failures with cognitive bias. So what we're...
This sounds a lot like Skynet, Dave.
I guess it does. I mean, and that's what scares people, right, is the idea that it's not inconceivable that soon a robot's going to be better at my job than me, right? And that's a scary thought, right? So do we want to build the same human biases into our robots that we have, or do we want to rise above them? Do we want to create robots that don't have these biases, and we have to admit that they have the ability to overcome certain things that we have to work very hard to overcome? Our cognitive biases can be overcome, but it's very hard for us to do. And we don't like when people tell us we're wrong. Think about when you're in an argument with a person, and a person scores big on that argument, and you know they're right, but you hate the idea of losing the argument. Usually a human response is to get really angry, get out of the conversation, and maybe later you realize they're right. Most people don't like to sit there and go, oh, you know, you're right. I'm sorry. Good job. Good argument. Right? This is the kind of thing we're going to be facing with robots on a daily basis. And it's going to be very fascinating to see whether we have the pride or the humility even to recognize that certain types of thinking robots are better.
Is there any data yet exists that's been done? Like, do we have any data yet on how many people have attacked bodily their robot managers? Because I have to imagine that the more robot managers there are, the more robot managers there are that will have been destroyed by angry people.
I think most robot managers right now exist in the cloud and are not actually physically attackable. But given the fact that we have people who roughly 20 people a year get killed by soda machines falling on them because they bodily attack a soda machine because they didn't get the right drink. I have no doubt that when a robot manager or an AI becomes something that can be more physically attacked, or just the monitor that is the final interface between me and my robot manager, I have no doubt that that's going to happen.
Yeah, they're going to have to give them maniacal laughs.
Well, I'm afraid that our timing robot is telling me that it's about time to wrap things up here on this episode of Information Week Live.
Are you really going to let a robot boss you around, Kurt?
I welcome the dawn of the age of our robotic overlords. I really do. So I see nothing but, I mean, what could go wrong? Really. Well, but before we're all replaced by robots, I think all of our panelists have some interesting stuff coming up for the coming week. Sarah, let's start with you. I know that security tends to be much more of a breaking news kind of area than a lot of others, but what's on your radar screen for the coming week?
Well, I am looking at some things with smart building security, and also whether the healthcare industry is paying any attention at all to Internet of Things security. I spoke to somebody who's managed to do a little bit of breaking into EEG systems, so I'll have a little bit more about that next week.
We will look forward to that. And for news on when that goes live, how can our listeners follow you on social media?
You can find me on Twitter at Sarah Peters. That's no H in Sarah. And then just keep your eyes on darkreading.com or on Information Week.
Very good. Sarah, thanks for being with us today.
Of course. Thank you.
Larry, we'll turn next to you. What's on your radar screen for the week ahead?
I'll be just trying to tap dance my way through Armageddon as usual. The interesting conversation that's been happening on Information Week for the last week is about ad blockers. There's been some breaking news on that. The one app that was Apple let out and then pulled had as its feature, it would block things in apps as well, not just on the web. I learned today that they're going to rescind that feature. That means that Apple's iAd in-app advertising program is now safe. We're going to have to see how that plays out.
Well, lots to follow there. And speaking of following, how can people do that for you on the Tweety Pipes and the rest of the social media?
Larry Loeb. I've been using my own name so long, it's actually worked. So just remember that, and you can get me almost anywhere.
How very old school. Just one of the things we love about Larry Loeb, a contributor here at Information Week. Thanks for being with us today, Larry.
My pleasure.
Well, Dave, that brings things around to you when you're not looking at the joys of imperfect robots. What are you going to be taking a look at in the coming days?
Yeah, Sunday I'm going to have an article on some other big tech mergers or acquisitions I wish would happen, some of which are serious, some of which are not, as is my usual Sunday fare. And next week I'm going to be doing, in honor of Halloween, a list of traits of the most horrible bosses. There's been some new research out recently about the types of bosses we all have to put up with and we all hate, and also a little advice on how to make it a little bit better. So be looking out for those monstrosities next week.
We will certainly be doing that. And how about you on the social media? What are you doing out there in the world of social following and leading?
Yes, you can find me at Geekend Dave. That's weekend, but with a G, Geekend Dave. You can also find me at Information Week and at allanalytics.com. I'll have a new article for All Analytics this week as well.
We will look forward to all of that. Dave, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, Kurt.
And as for me, I mentioned the piece on the new Intel Genuino 101 and Arduino 101. It'll be coming up over the weekend. Then next week, I'm going to be taking a deep look at some programming environments, some languages. It's interesting. I've been doing a fair amount with languages in the last couple of months, and people are getting back to me. So I've got some actually new things going on in some of the old languages that I'll be bringing everyone. In addition, I'm starting to get ready. In the middle of November, I'm going to be going down to a conference called FawcettCon, the free and open source conference that's being held over a couple of days at a hotel in Orlando, Florida. Among the other interesting things going on there will be a keynote address by Richard Stallman. And he is always entertaining to listen to, if nothing else. So we'll be bringing that to you. I'm getting ready for that. And to do so, I've added to my social media repertoire, in addition to my Twitter musings that happen. You can follow me at KG4GWA. Started to play with Periscope and having some fun with it, getting a lot of comments back. So if you haven't tried out Periscope, give it a shot. Follow me and let me know what you think about the little ad hoc videos that go up over the course of the day and the week. Well, that's it for Information Week Live for the week of October 11th, 2015. We really appreciate you being with us. If you're listening to this on an on-demand streaming version, I want to remind you that we do come to you live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you're here with us live, not only can you listen to our audio conversation, but you can take part in that great online text discussion that happens in the community. It's been a lively one today, and we look forward to more great discussions in the future. Well, for all of us here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin. Thanks for being with us. Hey, We'll see you next time.